Choke points. Let's go. Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Well, from what I saw, we survived the first full stop closure of I-5 pretty well, actually. But the main complaint, Chris, is not about that. It's about those lanes between Madison Street and the expressway.
Yeah, it's the number one question that I get about the Revive I-5 project. It has nothing to do with the repaving on I-5, but everything to do with the new lane configuration through the collector-distributor lanes that connect westbound I-90 to northbound I-5. The question is, when are we going to get our normal lanes into downtown? This is ridiculous. Well, I guess that's a question and a statement. If you haven't driven westbound I-90 into Seattle, here's what the state has done. It's removed 1,000 feet of lane from the Madison Street exit. We're right after it, actually. It's 1,000 feet of that people used to use to merge into the lanes that continue onto I-5 northbound. Madison Street is now an exit-only lane. That seemingly small tweak has caused daily 20-minute delays on I-90 through the morning commute. Some days it's much worse than that. That small tweak has turned that drive on the I-90 bridge just into something terrible, and it started as soon as they restriped the lanes. Tom Pierce with the Washington Department of Transportation says it's going to stay that way for a few more months.
We're going to keep this configuration through the summer, and it is possible it could carry on longer. We're going to keep an eye on it, and we'll make adjustments as necessary.
So why so long? Well, it turns out that the paving project on I-5 is now competing with other projects for closure time, meaning they're kind of staggering what gets closed all the time, so the projects kind of go a little bit longer here or there. And also, they're not going to close it on weekends with big events in Seattle, so we're starting to run into that. So now these weekend closures or lane restrictions on I-5 are only going to happen about once a month now.
We've got a full weekend scheduled for July 14th and 15th. We're going to have the freeway northbound down to two lanes the weekend of August 11th and 12th. We may need to schedule additional to get a little bit more completed that needs an entire weekend.
A lot of drivers are asking me, why can't the state just restripe this every time they're going to do it, so the daily commuters don't get penalized when work isn't underway? Well, the state tells me that it just makes more sense to keep the configuration in place because it would take too much time of the construction to restripe, unstripe, move the barriers, all sorts of stuff until the project is done. And other drivers have asked me why the state just can't get rid of the barrels that block that second lane from merging onto I-5. And Pierce tells me that one's a safety issue.
We need to have two lanes coming out of the collector distributor. That works great on a weekend when the main line is closed. When the main line is open, that left lane that we have barrels closing off right now, it comes into the main line at such an angle, it's an unsafe merge, and it would be dangerous to have that lane open and have cars trying to merge with northbound I-5.
So to my daily I-90 drivers like you, Dave, and like Bill, who talked to me all the time about this, how long you're going to have to suffer through this? It's going to be a couple of more months. I know when this opened up, I'm like, oh, don't worry, the Revive I-5 will probably be done by the middle of July. No, it may be late August or September before we get that normal lane configuration back.
Well, fortunately, at 4:30 in the morning, it doesn't seem to be a big concern.
That is true, and we are kind of getting into school out time and vacation time coming up over the summer, so there aren't as many. The volume will drop for summer, but still, they're going to stick. This thing's going to be, we're going to be stuck with this for another couple months.
But the result will be a beautiful, smooth, shiny new piece.
Yeah, if
of
you've
paper.
Driven the concrete on I-5 after the work they've done this weekend, it's really nice, but the pain is tremendous.
Yeah. The question we've been asking all week is, at what point in this fight to fix homelessness will we see fewer tents, fewer campers? And Kyrios Hannah Scott has been pressing that question. One of the questions I brought up yesterday was when the city consulted Barb Poppy, their homelessness consultant, one of the things she said was that you need to cut funding for those organizations that aren't actually resettling people. So what did you find out about that?
Okay, so the city's Human Services Department has contracts with dozens of homeless service providers. And last year, they revamped, based on that advice you just mentioned, the way that it works with them. The department's Human Services Department's Meg Oldberding says under the new policy for 2018, those providers would have to meet certain performance standards or lose 3% of their city funding each quarter.
The performance pay is really just tied to programs that are shelters or housing programs. So we want to see about a 40% rate at which they are moving people into housing or maintaining their housing. different kinds of programs have different percentages.
It's an effort to improve accountability and track whether the money the city spends on the homeless crisis is actually getting people off the streets. The first quarter of this year was the first time the city could enforce those performance requirements and cut that funding to providers that didn't meet them. But Oberding says they're taking things slower than they expected.
For the first quarter, because we had a large number of programs ramping up, we decided to not enforce the performance pay in the first quarter of 2018, but we are looking for that performance for the second quarter. So we will look at the exits to permanent housing and the rate of the exits to permanent housing or maintaining housing in order to look at funding for the second quarter.
So they'll look at those numbers here pretty quickly. That ends right through June, I think, is when the second quarter will end. And then they'll look at that. And then any of the providers that didn't meet those performance standards will lose 3% of their funding in the next quarter.
But so far, nobody's funding
so
has been
far,
cut.
So far, no provider has lost any funding based on those performance requirements at this point. But when the department first revamped this system late last year, it required the providers to compete for their 2018 contracts. And some providers didn't make the cut, including Sharon Wheel, agencies that, among other things, manage basic shelters that don't really do a lot to get people into permanent housing. At the time, the Human Services Department said that that didn't really meet the standards they were looking for. They prefer to focus on providers that offer more than just a mat on a floor like counseling and other services. But Oberding said some on the city council were upset and took matters into their own hands.
Those basic mat shelters are the ones that council added money for in the early part of 2018 to continue their funding through 2018.
So Share Wheel and other providers that didn't make the cut for the initial funding under the new system ended up getting funded for 2018 when the city council took action, did some bridge funding legislation in February. So those are all going to be funded all the way through the rest of this year. But while performance standards haven't yet been enforced, Oberding says city investments in the first 3 months of the year showed city-funded homeless programs helped more than 3,000 people move or maintain housing for the first 3 months of the year. But you sure wouldn't know it, right, when you're out looking through right. the city and there's tents lining sidewalks more than ever, it looks like. I asked Oberding why we can't see that progress on the streets.
So the 3,000 aren't just people on the streets. It's also people who are in shelters. It's people who are maintaining. They didn't enter into homelessness. We kept them off the streets, if you will. We know that there are almost 4,500 people without a roof over their heads, or they may be living in a car or in a tent. And so those are the people that the mayor is really trying to help with her new initiative of standing up 500 more spaces, safer spaces for people to move into.
And something interesting, I asked that, you know, we've talked about, I think last week, about the mayor's plan. How is 500 going to make that much of a difference when we're talking about numbers like 4,500 out in the streets? Yeah. She says it's important to note that that's 500 spaces that could amount to 1,500 or 2,000 people. So it could make a bigger dent than we thought. It's not just 500 people.
And what about families and in particular children?
As far as benchmarks or as far as...
Well, as far as getting them off the street. I mean, that was one of the things that was particularly disgraceful, is that there were so many children who had no place to sleep.
And that, again, I don't know that there are benchmarks. There for anything that the city does funding with, it has to be, I think it's 65% is the benchmark they have to meet to get those people into permanent housing within, I want to say it's 60 to 90 days. But they have to do it quickly. They have to get that 65% mark, or they'll lose that 3% funding every quarter.
And Dari asked whether they've changed the zoning to allow micro apartments.
I don't know about that. I know we're talking about upzoning, though. I believe there's a meeting tonight, and there was some discussion at council yesterday about that. That's a big, big focus, and as well as mandatory affordable housing, which, again, is those big developers have those apartment buildings that are for, you know, everyday people, and then 20 to 25% of those will be rent-controlled, essentially, or lower rent, and then those developers get a tax break. So there's a lot of discussion about that. Upzoning pretty much, I think, all over the city, because all we have is to go up to make some more affordable housing.
Kyra's Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
It's primary day in 8 states. That includes California, one of the key states, of course, when it comes to control the House of Representatives. And, pardon me, like us, they have a top 2 primary. They refer to it as a jungle primary. And you've probably been hearing reports that Democrats are worried because there are so many Democrats running in some of these districts that they might water down the field and hand the top 2 spots to Republicans. Well, I asked CBS News political consultant Leonard Steinhorn if that is, in fact, a real concern.
Yes, it is, especially since that they need those seats. The Democrats need those seats if they want to be able to win the House of Representatives in November. So any small margin of error, this makes the Democrats chew on their nails. There are 7 districts in California where Hillary Clinton won in 2016, and the Republican Party holds those congressional seats. And in 3 of those districts in particular, in Southern California, Orange County, there are so many Democrats on the ballot that the Democrats are worried that it may end up having 2 Republicans on the ballot in November, and the Democrats getting locked out. So this is a real palpable fear. If they can't pick up those seats, it's going to make it much more difficult for the Democrats to tip the House come November.
Did the Democratic Party try to make any official endorsements to discourage the also-rans?
Well, in one district, for example, the Democratic Party spent over $1 million to boost a particular candidate and attack a Republican so that the Democrat can beat that Republican and face the incumbent in November. So there's a lot of nervousness there. And so the Democratic Congressional Committee is trying to put its thumb on the scale a little bit, but then it gets some blowback from some of the grassroots Democrats who says that Washington Democrats shouldn't be coming in and telling how the local voters how to vote. So this is getting tricky. It's getting anxious. The Democrats are really having this white knuckle ride right now, because once again, if they can't pick up those seats, that could be the margin of difference as to whether the Democrats control the House or the Republicans do come 2019.
I saw a piece in the New York Times about the governor's race in California, where one of the candidates, Gavin Newsom, who I believe is the former mayor of San Francisco, actually bought ads on behalf of one of the Republicans running against him. Do you know anything about that?
Gavin Newsom would rather face a Republican in a heavily Democratic state than another Democrat, because you never know what can happen. So here's Gavin Newsom sort of favoring Republican John Cox, who is also endorsed by Donald Trump, because he doesn't want Antonio Villaraigosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles, making it into the general election in November, which would mean 2 Democrats and a potentially popular Democrat from Los Angeles. So in effect, here's a Democrat who's sort of hoping for a Republican because he thinks it would make it easier, but there are a lot of Democrats in the state who are upset with Newsom for doing that, because they feel that if there is a Republican on the ballot in November for governor, that might bring out more Republicans to vote. And in some of these close districts, the ones where Republicans have incumbents, even though Hillary Clinton won those districts, they don't want as much Republican turnout in November. Again, this is this big dramatic situation taking place because of the structure of the California primary, where it doesn't matter which party you're in, it's the first 2 vote getters in the primaries that move on to November, regardless of which party you're in.
We have the same process here in Washington State, by the way, although our primary is much later in the year, so there's a chance to sort of weed out the field. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think to some extent it's good in the sense that it sort of takes party out of it and allows a district or a state to choose the people that they think are most qualified. But what happens is when the candidate slate gets so cannibalized among many different candidates that somebody with just, you know, a small 1 or 2 or 3% of the vote who has a lot of supporters or who just happens to have a name on the ballot in the right place that people choose could pry votes away from another candidate and keep that candidate from getting into the general election in November, and ultimately undermining the will of the voters who might prefer, let's say, 2 members from a particular party in a particular district running against each other. So it's got its upsides and its downsides. Its upsides are when each party puts up a couple of candidates who are fairly popular and they don't get cannibalized by other minor candidates, but it's got its downside when a particular party would be the natural to present candidates in November, and they could get locked out altogether, is what may happen to the Democrats this year.
CBS News political consultant Leonard Steinhorn. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We talk a lot about why boys behave the way they do, and maybe it's because of the way that they're being raised. And a lot of people have studied this, including Harvard professor Dr. J. Stuart Ablon, author of a book titled Changeable, which would imply that some of these really stubborn behaviors can, in fact, be changed?
It certainly is about some of the misconceptions that we have about why people, including young men, misbehave, and as a result, what we need to be thinking about doing differently.
Well, first, let's identify what it is that parents or guardians are doing when they're raising boys that you've identified as problematic.
Sure. Well, the first thing is that the conventional wisdom when kids misbehave is that the reason they're misbehaving is because they're using their behavior to either get stuff they want or get out of stuff they want and stuff like that. And that's actually been disproven. There's been about a half a century of research in the neurosciences that has shown that kids who actually act out aren't lacking in the will to behave well. In fact, what they lack are the skills to behave well. And that's actually good news that it's about skill, not will, because skills can be taught, they can be practiced, and they can be developed both at home, at school, and other places as well.
Let's get right down to the tough conversation, because when we're talking about the behavior of boys and acting out, what comes to mind are cases that we've been seeing in school shootings where there is an ex-lover or a love interest and they feel jilted. And so they take it out in the most extreme way, in a violent way. What is it that these young men are missing in their development? What skill are they missing that parents or guardians aren't teaching that results in such a violent and deadly conclusion?
Kids or anybody, for that matter, who exhibits very aggressive, horrific behavior like that typically have deficits in all kinds of problem-solving skills, what we call emotion regulation skills, which is a fancy way of saying how you're able to manage or control your emotions, flexible thinking skills, frustration tolerance, etc. And the reality is, unfortunately, in most of these cases where we've got horrific violence happening, particularly in schools, those kids have showed up on the radar earlier. They've exhibited other forms of challenging behavior. And unfortunately, we've used conventional wisdom and conventional approaches. And things like detentions and suspensions and expulsions, traditional school disciplinary practices, they just flat out don't work when the problem is a lack of skill, not will. And in fact, not only do they not work, but they make matters worse. So what we really need to do here is follow the science. When a kid is acting up in school, realize it's about skill, not will, and get down to the work of helping build those skills so we can try to avert these terrible tragedies that occur later on.
So you would prohibit detention?
I think detention is really helpful for kids that, frankly, don't need it. Kids who have the skills to behave well. And so if they misbehave and they get a detention and they react to that detention and control their behavior next time around, that just confirms that they have the skills to do what we want. But it's a rare kid who gets one detention. Most of the time, detentions and suspensions don't decrease over the time. They increase in every large school district across the United States of America, which proves they just don't work. So it's not like I'm anti-detention. I'm fine with using detention for things it works for. But let's not use it for things it doesn't work for, and then being surprised when A, it doesn't work, and B, it makes matters worse.
Are parents or have parents been so absent that this is what has resulted? Is the creation of these monsters who are capable of such horrific violence?
No, I think that's a terrible oversimplification, to be honest. I'm a clinical psychologist, and psychologists and psychiatrists have been blaming parents, and particularly moms, for a long time for things we later learned they had a whole less to do with than we thought. We used to blame parents for what we now know are learning disabilities. We used to blame parents for what we know now is autism, very complicated neurodevelopmental difficulty. And so it's just not fair to blame parents for their kids' challenging behavior, because it's easy to sit back and judge. But you know what? If you've got an easy kid, they're easy to parent. You got a very tough kid, it makes us parents look pretty clueless pretty quickly. And what we typically do when we see a parent struggling is we come down hard on them, saying that they should come down harder on their kids.
That's true.
And coming down harder on kids doesn't help them build skills that they're lacking again in the first place.
That's true. So, the first thing I think when I see an incident of this is what went wrong with the parenting. So,
right.
So whose responsibility then is it? Where do these skill deficits show up, and whose job is it to make sure they're fixed?
Well, it's the responsibility of parents and teachers, and for that matter, any other adult that spends time around these kids. But we can't expect parents and teachers to do right by these tricky kids unless we help them understand what's making them tricky in the first place. So if we teach parents that harsher punishment is the way to go, tough love, we can't then blame them when it doesn't work. And similarly, if we teach traditional school disciplinary strategies, we can't come down on teachers when those things fail. We need to know what's causing these things and use different strategies. And this is the good news, folks, is that we now know why traditional discipline fails our most challenging kids. And we have proven alternatives. It's time to get the word out, which is why I'm so happy when people are willing to have me on a show like this and listen to what we have to say.
Harvard professor J. Stuart Ablon, who is the author of Changeable, Yes, You Can Fix Bad Behavior. And it's about, let me see if I remember this properly, skill, not will.
You got it. Well done.
Thanks, Professor. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And now your daily dose of kindness. It took months to raise enough money to pull off her acts of kindness, but the determination of a six-year-old should not be underestimated. Brinley Williams spent some time in the hospital from the time of birth until she turned six due to some kidney issues. And during that time in the hospital, she'd received one of those coveted American Girl dolls. It made her feel good. And again, at 6 years old, she realized that she could do the same for other kids in the hospital. So when she got out, she set out to raise enough money to buy dolls for kids staying at St. Francis Children's Hospital in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She started with the good old-fashioned lemonade stand. She raised $400. Do you guys ever remember raising anything close to $100? Yeah. Then she worked at a restaurant owned by a family friend, did some chores around the restaurant for some money. Well, community members caught on to this six-year-old restaurant worker, began over-tipping her, and she bumped her total to $1,500. That was enough for 15 dolls. And she says she plans to hand-deliver them later this month to the Children's Hospital.
It's time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. Let's talk about the Mariners, because they're going up against Houston. This is a chance to pick up some ground, huh?
It's a showdown. Houston's the defending World Series champion. They were the presumed favorite, not just in the division, but in the American League. And somehow the Mariners come into this game a game up, a game ahead of the Astros in the standings. You got James Paxton, the Mariners' best pitcher, on the hill against Dallas Keuchel.
Nice.
He's a former Cy Young Award winner, but he's had a bit of a rough go. I think he's got seven losses, and I'm really excited to see. This isn't sort of a measuring stick to see where Seattle is, but they haven't played great teams. They've played the schedule that they've been dealt. They've played a schedule very similar to Houston's, actually. I'm excited to see what happens here.
Yeah, this really feels good, and it's the first time in a while that people have been this enthusiastic about the team, so go M's. Is Portland going to get a baseball team?
I don't think so. Russell Wilson certainly would like him to.
Is he investing in it?
He and his wife, Sierra, are now affiliated with one of the groups of Bring Baseball to Portland. Russell's MO in his outside football business ventures is to lend his name for equity stake in different things, whether it's Eat the Ball. Were you ever familiar with that product?
No.
Eat the Ball. It was bread shaped like a football, and it was called Eat the Ball. It was bread shaped like a football.
Yeah, I get it. You can make a really nice sub out of that.
Yeah, what I heard when I first thought it, I was like, oh, this is really cool. It was like this thing that was going to feed like developing countries.
Yeah.
It was going to provide all the nutrients. No.
No.
It was just bread shaped like a football.
Well, you could play a game with it, and then you all eat it afterwards. Very sustainable. So he doesn't put any money in it?
Generally not. I don't know, because I haven't seen them, but it seems to me like the Goodman brand. There was a water drink with nanobubbles. I can't remember what that was called, but he claimed that the bubbles had helped him prevent him getting a concussion in the NFC Championship game a couple of years ago, and his agent was like, no, you can't say that. And he's like, I do really think that. And it's like, no, the FDA has rules about that sort of thing.
Is Portland a big enough market to sustain a major league team?
It's close. Yeah, there are smaller cities that have baseball teams. There's certainly an infrastructure question of where would the park be, and it's 3 hours away from Seattle. Would you really? It would be one of the smaller teams. I think that there's other places that would be in line to get a team first. Mexico City, I would think would have its hand up and,
really?
And raise its hand. Yeah, there's both leagues. The NBA has made noise about wanting to go to Mexico City as
really?
Well.
Well, why not? We do Canada.
Yeah, there's a real belief that that could be a burgeoning and just an absolute dynamo of a market if you got in there.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of Portland, the Western Division, very easy team to beat.
What should their name be? I've got a great one.
Yeah, what?
Portland Little Brothers.
Portland Little Loggers.
Yeah, we're gonna go take on our little brothers. Seattle's rival is the Little Brothers.
Hey, your dream is coming true. Howard Schultz is apparently dropping out of Starbucks to get into politics.
Hey, you know what's awesome? If you want him to sell our nation state to Greece, dress it up as that being the only way to truly save our country, and then have the gall to announce the entire transaction with balloons as if it's a celebration. Howard Schultz is your guy.
Yeah.
If you want somebody that's going to use big, high-minded phrases like civic trust, and then at the first sign of dissension or trouble, just turn tail and run like a coward, Howard is your guy.
So I'm guessing you're not going to be his sports czar in the Schultz administration.
There's one reason that I hope he runs, and one reason only. I would love to see in either a run-up for the nomination or a presidential debate him be forced to answer for the fact that he sold that team, our oldest franchise, and try to explain away why we should trust him with the country when Seattle couldn't even trust him with a basketball team.
You're going to be on the panel questioning?
I would love to. I would love to.
Danny O'Neill from 710 ESPN Seattle, our sports insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The Supreme Court gave a win to the Masterpiece Cake Shop in Colorado on Monday, but is it a win for any other business? Does that mean that bakers can at will discriminate against gay couples or florists or photographers for that matter? Let's consult with Adam Winkler, who's a professor of constitutional law at UCLA, has briefed the Supreme Court before and has also written a book called We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. This seemed to be pretty specific to this case because it cited the way that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission handled this, and remind us what the court found objectionable about their handling of this.
Well, this case could have been a very, very broad ruling, but instead it was very narrow in that the court said that the problem here was that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had expressed hostility towards particular religious beliefs, and that no one should be forced to go before such a commission and be treated unequally because of their religion. And that's an important ruling, but it also is a narrow one. The case presented the much larger question about whether businesses would have a right to discriminate against people. The court really punted on that question.
You point out in your commentary on this that the baker said the company and me are one in the same when it comes to religion. So as my religious feelings go, so go the company's. But if someone slips and falls in his bakery today and sues the baker personally, he will say, no personal liability because I'm protected by the corporation. Did the Supreme Court handle that aspect of the case at all?
The court did not handle that kind of ironic twist in the case where a business owner gets to say that his religion can be expressed through his corporation because he and the corporation are really one and the same thing. But the truth is the law imposes a real basic restriction and clear boundary between the rights of individuals who make up a corporation and the rights of the corporation. That's why if you slip and fall at Starbucks or at the bakery, you have to sue the corporation. You can't sue the individual shareholder.
Well, doesn't it depend, though, on how closely held it? Wasn't that the issue in the Hobby Lobby case? The reason that Hobby Lobby could impose its feelings on birth control on its employees was because this wasn't a Starbucks-type corporation with a lot of shareholders. This was very closely held by the owners.
That's right. And the Hobby Lobby case was slightly different because it wasn't a constitutional case. It was a case about a federal statute. And the court said that the federal statute had intended to include corporations within the scope of religious freedom. Today's ruling was about the Constitution itself. And the Hobby Lobby case did make a distinction between a publicly held corporation and a closely held corporation, although it did not draw any very firm boundaries saying that one has rights that the other doesn't.
Okay, so then what would be your guidance for bakeries whose owners are deeply religious and can't abide gay marriage, and to gay couples who walk into a bakery or a florist or a photographer? Is there a way that either side needs to behave for the transaction to be, or the refusal to be, constitutional?
Well, it was very interesting. There was a debate among the justices in the separate opinions about this very question. The court's majority opinion avoided it altogether. But in a concurring opinion, Justice Kagan argued that these laws that bar discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, if they're applied neutrally, apply to everyone, and no bakery gets an exemption. Meanwhile, Justice Gorsuch, in his concurring opinion, wrote that a religiously motivated baker would have a very strong First Amendment case to fight against anti-discrimination laws.
So then there seems to be no consistent rule. It just goes state by state.
Well, I think what we are is the court really punted on the big question. Can businesses discriminate if they have religious beliefs against same-sex marriage? And that's just a question that the court left for another day. This was obviously the biggest issue before the court this year, and apparently the justices could not come to an agreement about how to answer it.
By the way, since the manner of debate in the Colorado Human Rights Commission seemed to be what persuaded the court in this case to go with the bake shop, because of the way that the Civil Rights Commission seemed to be dismissive of the religious beliefs of the owners, would that apply to things like, a ban on Muslims? I mean, would you then have to constitutionally read that in light of some of the president's comments on the campaign trail?
Well, that was one of the really interesting things from the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. The court said that when dealing with issues of religious discrimination, we can look at these kinds of statements by lawmakers to express their motivation. And if we see religious hostility clearly expressed, then that undermines the decision, even if that commission might have made the exact same decision without religious hostility. That suggests that even if President Trump can ban people from certain countries from coming in here, his often expressed religious motivations for doing so could be looked at by the Supreme Court and used as a basis for challenging the travel ban.
I'm curious, did Justice Gorsuch come down on that side of the argument or not?
No, he did not. There was even a little bit of disagreement among the justices about sort of how to think about these statements. So it seems clear that some justices were thinking about the travel ban case while they were writing this opinion, too.
I see. Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law at UCLA. Professor Winkler, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
By the way, David Farenthold, who you usually hear at this time on a Tuesday, is on vacation this week.